This is the current federal tax developments for the week of April the 10th, 2017. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Nichols Patrick CP, a division of the Lascalzo Institute, and your state society of CPAs. This week, we're going to take a look at a few news stories. I'm going to start with a discussion of what I'll call news briefs. These are ones where we didn't write a full article. I want to discuss those some things that came up this week you probably want to know about that maybe don't have long-term impact, but have impact right now. We'll also talk about some costs incurred with regard to a merger and whether we have to capitalize those and the IRS's views on that point. We'll take a look at an employment tax dispute and the fact that a taxpayer, in what's probably a significant case for taxpayers involved in such disputes, was able to gain access to information about returns filed by their contractors. And we'll talk about why that's significant. Finally, we'll talk to you about the fact that the private collection agencies have now begun receiving accounts from the IRS, and we'll talk about the issues that come into play and some of the things we got to worry about there as we get those accounts running to the private collection agencies. So this week, let's start with these news briefs because we have a few things coming up, and I want to consider three key news briefs here. I'm going to start with briefly some information was in testimony that the IRS commissioner provided to the Senate Finance Committee this week that was reported by Tax Notes in Tax Notes Today. And the report talked about the fact the commissioner in his testimony discussed something that we'd heard about. You may have remembered there was a notification early March that the free student financial aid, the free application for federal student financial aid, FAFSA form, that electronic form had been taken offline in early March. And had been taken offline because of concerns about some ways that people may have been breaching information, being able to take information from the IRS site. Why that's an issue is because the FAFSA site had been set up to allow those applying for student aid to be able to, once they had gotten certain information into the system, access the tax information that's necessary to fill out that form. A lot of us have had that situation with clients who, you know, get really hyper about wanting tax information early in tax season done, which of course is a little bit of a problem because none of the 1099s have come out. But we had all those issues to fill out the form for financial aid. Well, this was the online version to help, you know, get that information. It's one of these issues where it was convenient. You know, the government knows these things. They have it in their system. Why should I have to go dig out my old tax returns? You know, I could just get it from the government system. I'm not trying to cheat anybody. I just want to use what we have in the government system. So it sounds great up front. The problem is convenience and security almost always go against each other. And that turned out to be the problem here. The commissioner testified that 100,000 taxpayers are being notified that hackers may have been able to access their personal data. What they would do, they would get enough personal data to start an application on the financial aid site. Eventually, that would allow them to get to the point where they need to provide the IRS information, the tax return information. They would, by using that, be able to directly kick over. The IRS information would come over because it was automatically linked, and they would be able then to complete the form. Once they completed the form, there'd be a lot of stuff filled in on the form that would give them more data about the information whose identity, about the individual, I should say, whose identity they were trying to steal. As I say, wonderful convenience, but unfortunately also wonderful security flaw. So right now they're working on it. They are trying to figure out a way around the problem, but we do know the nature of it again. 100,000 got loose, and that's one of our problems that we have. And they think there's about 8,000 refunds that totaled about $30 million were issued on tax returns that were filled out with that information they've discovered now. So as we say, you know, the guys trying to do this, they find ways around systems, and we have to worry about the fact of convenience versus security. Always great. We want things to be convenient, but unfortunately, especially in IT, convenience almost always means that there's going to be a security hole somewhere. It doesn't take these guys long to find it. And they obviously did. The other little thing the IRS released in News Release 2017-72, they want everybody to know that there's $1 billion that's about to end up going to the government permanently because the IRS estimates there's $1 billion of unclaimed tax refunds from 2013 tax returns. And since we're coming up on April, you know, we're coming up on the filing deadline in 2017, That means we're coming up for 16 returns. We're about to come up to the end of the three-year period for claiming the refund on those 13 returns that weren't filed, but which have refunds available. So the IRS issued their standard warning that if you're in that situation, obviously you need to file your claim real quick. It needs to get in before the filing deadline. So just interesting, we do know the number. It's $1 billion. So, well, it's, you know, considering our deficits these days, that's not that much money, but I guess every little bit helps. Finally, the IRS and News Release 2017-71 gave a new warning about a bunch of phishing emails. And this makes a lot of sense. It's an end of tax season time. We all know tax professionals at the end of tax season, this is a very high stress time. There's lots of things happening. The worst thing in the world that could happen is something goes wrong. And that something going wrong could stop you from being able to do certain things. You know, we just had the issue this week. I just had one computer in the office that for whatever reason now refuses to work with our tax software after crashing. And of course, that was a crisis because we're trying to get returns done. The person involved needed things. Okay, understand the crisis mode and the problem. The bad guys are going to take advantage of that situation. They are sending out emails to tax professionals that tell you that immediate action is necessary because your account has been, well, they have different titles. They may say that it is going to be basically a subject line may say account closure, e-service account is blocked, few hours to close your account is closed, your account is terminated, 24 hours to block your account. All of these are meant to panic you into believing I need to do something right now. I'm going to lose access to e-services, potentially even e-filing, if I don't do something right away. Obviously, when you go, you click on the link, you're going to a scam site that looks like the IRS sign-in, but they're going to get your credentials. Obviously, they would then plan to use those credentials for nefarious purposes. And the practical matter is they realize that right now, high stress, this is the perfect time to come after somebody because they're not thinking about this issue. They are totally 100% into other matters at this point. That is the time that you are most vulnerable to being taken. So gang, be careful out there. This is probably not the only type of phishing email or type of scam email that'll be directed at tax professionals during this time of year. It's a high stress time. That unfortunately means that it's a lot easier to attack you during a high stress time. So don't be surprised if an attack comes. Now let's go on to our standard stories. And these have the written details that you'll find in our materials on the website. We're going to start with Chief Counsel Advice 2017-13010, was issued on March the 31st. And this case looked at expenditures that were made by a taxpayer that were related to a merger the taxpayer was going through. Now, if you look at Regulation 1.263A-5A, you'll notice that there's a lot of costs for certain intangibles, including mergers, that need to be capitalized. That's a section. You may remember that a couple of years ago, we had the tangible property regulations. This was the older intangible property regulations have similar ideas. General rule is we're acquiring an asset. Well, we're merging. So we're acquiring another company. Part of the costs that have to be capitalized as part of that acquisition are costs that facilitate that acquisition. Okay. The agent in this case was looking at this fact pattern. The merger had to be cleared by a regulatory board. The regulatory board, to allow the merger to take place, required certain things happen. For instance, they required to give a rate credit to every customer of the acquired company. So we essentially had to do that. Okay, that's some spending of money. We had to contribute to a customer investment fund to provide long-term benefits to the acquired company's customers. We had to make payments to the state for development of something, doesn't tell us what, because they obviously redact this. And there's a commitment to provide a certain amount of dollars per year to charitable organizations and traditional local community report within the state. It actually was to continue that level of support. Now, the agent said, well, you know, the companies agreed to do all of this stuff so the merger could go forward. The agent's now saying, well, none of those costs, the test is, would those costs have been incurred but for the merger? And the agent claims if they wouldn't have been incurred but for the merger, then obviously they're facilitative costs of the merger, and none of those are currently deductible. In fact, the real problem is they become permanently capitalizable because there's no real way to amortize them out. So that's a problem, as you may say. Well, the chief counsel's office was called in on this, and they weren't so sure it works this way. They said, here's the problem. An amount to facilitate an intangible transaction under Regulation 1.263A-5, specifically in the preamble, the note said that facilitative standard is narrower in scope than a but-for standard. And they put out, this is what the agent's using. Some transaction costs that arguably are capital under but-for standard are not necessarily have to be capitalized. The question really comes down to, does this look like costs that traditionally would be part of a, you know, of an acquisition, or are these just regular style transaction costs? And the memorandum says you cannot use a but-for standard and require these costs to be capitalized. They're saying rather you have to look at the nature of the cost. They point out that, for instance, those contributions, the company was already making those contributions. They just agreed to continue to make them as a condition of the merger. They said, we didn't suddenly convert from a deductible expense to a non-deductible one merely by going through the merger. As well, the other costs were traditional costs of carrying on the business. So they said, none of that's going to work. The but-for standard is not there. We're looking at traditional types of facilitative costs, things like paying the attorneys, the legal fees, you know, the registrations, all those sorts of things. We're not going to be so worried about the fact that you have to reduce how much revenue you're going to receive from certain customers. You had to do certain other expenditures. If those expenditures are in and of themselves ordinary necessary expenses, we're going to be able to take them currently. You can't just automatically capitalize them. Secondly, the agent said, well, he had a different theory. Under Regulation 1.263A-5E24, it states that costs of obtaining regulatory approval are inherently facilitative and therefore under the reg have to be capitalized. They said, well, even if the but-for standard is not there, these were costs of obtaining regulatory approval. The memorandum concluded you can't read that broadly. In essence, as it said, the cost of obtaining regulatory approval include the cost of preparing for and appearing before the regulatory board. The phrase regulatory approval should not be read so broadly that it includes any and all costs to address conditions that might be imposed by regulators. In reality, if you think about it, this would become a very quick slippery slope. You know, you go in, you make some concessions, you talk with the board talks about certain things. I mean, how many things are you agreeing to or potentially could have impact for decades? And could have costs incurred for decades as part of agreeing to, you know, to get your merger done. If we're allowed you to just simply say all of that had to be capitalized, then this could be a very unworkable standard. So I think the memorandum comes to the proper conclusion that you do not read this under a but-for super broad standard, nor do we consider costs of regulatory approval to be anything that the board imposes on you as a condition, but rather simply your costs of going before the board for the approval. So for that reason, it's one of these things where if you have one of these issues where you need to do, where you have a merger and you're trying to get approval, you might see that in utility. You may see that in other types of structures where you may need some approvals. Realize that it's not super broad how much you have to yank in if you have conditions imposed on you. That in this case, the national office thought that was going just a bit far. Next up, the question becomes, when can the IRS disclose information about other taxpayers to a taxpayer who would be impacted by that information? And I am going to apologize to the tribe in question because I'm going to mispronounce the name here. But the Mescalero Apache tribe, this is a tribe in southeastern New Mexico, southeastern, southwestern, I can't remember the actual background here, versus commissioner. 148 TC number 11, this came out on April the 5th. And this is a payroll tax case. Now the tribe had employed a bunch of people. And some of those people, you know, the government had employed them. They were employed as independent contractors. Well, the IRS came in with a payroll tax exam. And as we all are kind of aware, IRS agents rarely see anybody they don't think's an employee. So right now, a whole bunch of those contractors, the IRS wants to have set up as employees. And we're not really dealing with here whether or not they're correct that they should be employees. We're kind of, this case is complicated, has a number of issues. So the court was just looking at one particular issue here. Now, let's assume, though, for the moment, if those people were truly employees, the tribe could be stuck with having to pay the taxes that should have been withheld on their wages under Section 3402, unless the tribe can prove that those individuals had actually reported the income on their tax returns. 3402D allows that to be done. So I've got a whole bunch of people the IRS wants to classify as employees. If I can get statements from them that say they reported this as income on their tax return, then I'm allowed to, I don't get rid of penalties and interest, but I do get rid of the tax, which is can be fairly significant because, you know, we have to do the withholding. So that's a lot of money, and that is a lot of money for the tribe. Well, the tribe, obviously, while they're contesting the service on whether these people should be employees, they very smartly, I mean, you know, you cover all your bases. They went out and got these statements from the contractors to show that they had reported taxes on their return, right? You might as well be ready in case you don't carry the issue. Well, there were 70 people they could not contact. And the reasons they couldn't has to do somewhat with just the nature of the very rural area that the tribe is located in. They're in very remote locations. They have 70 people they couldn't find. Some of these people had moved, and they simply don't have a current address for these people. Others lived in very remote locations that had no cell service, no utilities. They simply had not been able to contact these people. They had no way of getting a hold of them. So, you know, the tribe said, well, you know, we can't find these people. But there is somebody besides these individuals who know whether they reported these items on their tax return. And that's the IRS. So the board asked in discovery in this case for information from the IRS about whether those 70, you know, had actually reported the income on their tax return. The IRS said, wait a minute. We're not allowed to disclose taxpayer information to third parties. Section 6103 of the code specifically prohibits us from doing that. So sorry, tribe, but you know, we're simply not allowed to do that. We can't give you that information. Now, you know, the court points out, well, it is kind of obvious. The IRS obviously knows the answer to this question. And this is a court case. And as the court says, eventually the bottom line, isn't this what discovery is for? To find out what the other side has? But they did note we have this problem with 6103. Now, the court said, well, it's wonderful. We have a general rule that says it can't be given. But as the court said, every time we have a general rule, we have exceptions to the general rule. And so we have to take a look at this issue. Is there an exception? The court said there is a rule at 6103H4, which allows for disclosure in judicial administrative proceedings. And a return or return information, according to this section, may be disclosed in a federal or state judicial administrative proceeding pertaining to tax administration, but only, essentially, if the treatment of an item reflected on such return is directly related to the resolution of an issue in the proceeding, or if such return or return information directly relates to a transactional relationship between a person who is a party to the proceeding and the taxpayer, which directly affects the resolution. Now, the court notes that B there, the first part of that, the treatment of item reflected on the return, not going to be obvious on the return necessarily if this was on there. So we're looking at, as the court points out, return information, not necessarily the return information, more detailed, which could include things like the 1099s the IRS has and their CP2000 matching. So they said B doesn't really solve this because just the return itself is probably not going to help. So the question becomes, does C? It does such return or return information directly relate to a transactional relationship between a person who is a party, that would be the tribe, you know, to the proceeding and the taxpayer, or should say the contractor and the taxpayer, which directly affects the resolution of an issue in the proceeding. And the court said, well, maybe. Now, they did note the first circuit court to consider this item was the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in the case of Chamberlain versus Kurtz in 1979. There they concentrated on the title of H in total, which talks about disclosure to Treasury officials. And they said, well, that limits it. You're not a Treasury official. You couldn't get it. However, the court said other circuits have not followed the Fifth on this one, and specifically the Tenth Circuit has not. In First W Government Security versus United States in 1986, the Tenth Circuit noted the Fifth's ruling, but just said they got it wrong and allowed for such things to happen. Basically, so we look, though, at this. So do they qualify? The court said it is the Tenth Circuit, so they could qualify. So we're not going to say the fact that a Treasury official is going to block this. Well, they said, first, we have to have a transactional relationship. Next, they said, does it directly relate to this relationship? And finally, is the relationship directly affect the resolution of the issue? Well, the court first concludes that transact means just to carry on business. Wide variety of relationship. There are transactional relationships between the tribe and the contractors. That's no problem. The second one, you know, basically, had to deal with the question of whether it directly relates to the transactional relationships. And there they went and cited a Nebraska District Court case, Guarantee Mutual Life, which is a case that came up back in 1978, that we had the information of getting information about employees from the IRS. And in that case, they essentially found that, yes, in this case, the issue directly relates to the relationship. You know, whether or not these people believe they were employees or contractors, whether they believe that taxable income or not, directly relates to did they report on their tax return. So the court found that, yes, the transaction directly relates to the issue. And finally, the third one, does the information related to the transaction directly affect the resolution? Well, yeah. If they reported the income, then the IRS doesn't get the tax on that particular person, even if the IRS carries the issue at the end of the day. So the court found that in a case like this, the IRS does have to provide that information. Now, the IRS squawked, wait, this is, you know, this reverses the burden of proof because, you know, the burden of proof is on them to show the employees paid the tax, not on us to prove they didn't. The court said, now, IRS, you're confusing discovery with burden of proof. I can satisfy my burden of proof by getting information that is discoverable from the other party. The court said this is going to be a discoverable item. So the taxpayer is allowed to ask in discovery for the information from the service related to the employee. Now, for practical matters, that does probably mean the burden's now on the service to make this work. Finally, this week, we're going to take a look at the fact that the IRS announced in news release IR 2017-74 that private collection agencies have now actually received accounts from the service. So this is something we've talked about before. The notice reminds us that the IRS is going to contact people first, and then the credit collection agency is going to contact these individuals. It reminds us again, there are only four agencies that are going to be given these contracts. CBE Group of Cedar Falls, Iowa, Conserve of Fairport, New York, Performat of Livermore, California, and Pioneer of Horseheads, New York. Those four are the only ones who should be contacting anybody. The other problem is, you know, they tell us these private firms, points out, are authorized to disclose payment options, setting up payment agreements with taxpayers. You know, payments have to be made to the IRS. They're not made to this agency. What they cannot do is take any enforcement action. So remember, the collection agencies cannot initiate a filing of a notice of federal tax lien, nor can they issue a levy. There is a new private debt collection page on the IRS website that's referenced in this news release that will update you as things develop on this. The news release also goes on to warn us about the potential for scam, because that's been a concern of most of us when Congress first came up with this idea, is are scammers going to latch on to this? Remember the FAFSA problem. Scammers are pretty good at latching on to things, whatever they see a way they can get an advantage. And again, high stress situation like those e-services emails. Yeah, you know, calling somebody up and saying that you owe the federal government $20,000 is going to high stress phone call. So yeah, we would expect scams. So they want you to remember the private collection firms only be called by the tax debt you've had for quite a while. You should be totally aware of this debt. Nobody should get a call who's not aware they're owed money. This is not the first letter you're going to get, or that money is owed to the agency. So the IRS should be, you know, people have to be aware that those calls will go out. You know, you're not going to get a call unless you have unpaid tax debts going back several years. You've already heard from the IRS multiple times. You know, in essence, if you, you know, you should know you have a tax issue. If somebody calls, claim to be a collection agency, and you're not aware of a tax issue, hang up. Right? There's lots of things to worry about and do this. And you should warn your clients to contact you if they get such a call. Because while there have not yet been reports of such a call, obviously that's the kind of thing that would not be surprising to see down the line. Well, we're getting to that time of year again. It's the end, nearly the end of tax season. And we want to talk to you a little bit about, we're getting close, but you're going to start making decisions about live full-day CPE. And we have a lot of options these days, so why should you be considering live full-day CPE from your state society? Well, there are probably a few important things you need to think about when taking a look at those catalogs. You do gain direct interaction with an expert who's available for the full day. You're not talking with somebody you're not here on the phone, right? You're not here having to submit and type into chat boxes and get questions that are answered 20 minutes after they talked about something. You're able to get real live direct interaction with people in the room. What's also important is you gain direct interaction with other local CPAs, CPAs who have the same type of client in your area. That's one of the big things you get from going to a live seminar, is the ability to talk with others. Yes, online's great, online's wonderful, online's convenient, but online does not give you that sort of networking that you get at a live stage situation. And finally, you're gaining targeted information to serve your clients. When you go to a full-day CPE course, live CPE, you tend to have a full day targeted on a specific subject, which helps you deal with your client's problems and how they're affected. Something that's very difficult to do if you're taking your CPE in these short bursts where you take an hour or two-hour webinar. I've given those, I do those. But you're obviously just not going to get as many nuggets to go away as you will if you're there for a full day with access to those who are there, with access to the instructor. So be looking out for those catalogs. Number of state CPA societies are beginning to release their CPE calendars for the year online. So you can go check those online right now. Also, the print catalogs that most societies are going to turn out will be coming normally right here during the month of April. Hopefully, they usually try to time them so they're after the filing deadline. They don't arrive before, but somewhere just after the 18th filing deadline, you're going to be seeing those. And we just ask you to consider, for those of us here at Nichols Patrick and the rest of the Lascalzo Institute, you know, consider looking at the courses, signing up, and we all look forward to seeing you at those days. And come out and see us and take your continuing education from your state society. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of April 10th, 2017. You want to catch our updates during the week at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also download a PDF with articles on today's topics on the website. So go there on our weekly updates. You'll find the link there. You can send any questions or comments regarding this week's presentation to edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also follow me on Twitter. My Twitter address is @edzollers. I'm not going to fully promise that next week's broadcast is coming out on time. I've got a whole bunch of filing deadline things like the rest of you, but hopefully we'll get something out, if not right at the beginning of the week, somewhere just after the filing deadline. So keep a look. I'll try to make it on Monday, but don't bet on it. Try to make it as normal. So we look forward to seeing you whenever we get our next one up. We look forward to seeing you on the next broadcast here for the Current Federal Tax Developments.